There is an important novel written by Roald Dahl. I think it's Ronald without the N. A British chap, no longer living. He wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but he also wrote a book that I enjoyed listening to Kathy read to our children, some, called The BFG, which stands for anyone? Anyone? I'm sorry, bearded fellow? Big Friendly Giant. Yes, I know it's Matt and Lisa. They both knew the title. And so did many of you. Well done, children. The BFG, the Big Friendly Giant. The Big Friendly Giant one night takes Sophie from her room. This is just a story, children. And she's in this land of giants. And she's puzzling over this new reality that she's been exposed to. And she asks the giant, "What do you live on?" She's asking, what does he eat? You know, because most of the other giants eat children. It's a rated G story. And he says to her, in response to the question, "What, oh giant, do you live on? What do you eat?" And he says, "Well, that's a squelching, tricky problem around here." In this, he comes up with great words, "in this slosh-funking giant country, happy eats like pineapples and pigwinkles is simply not growing. Nothing is growing except for one extremely icky-poo vegetable." And I know there's a lot of you, even grown-ups, who think many vegetables are icky-poo. "There's only one extremely icky-poo vegetable that grows here, and it is called the snozcumber." "The snozcumber," said Sophie. "There's no such thing as a snozcumber." And the BFG looked at Sophie, and he smiled, showing about 20 of his square white teeth. And he says to her, "Now, yesterday, we was not believing in giants, was we? Today, we is not believing in snozcumbers." Thank you, Mary Alice. I like that. This is funny. And that is the appropriate response. "Just because," he says, "just because we happen not to have actually seen something with our own little winkles, we think it is not existing." That's his clever way of saying, don't be a numbskull, Sophie. You think just because you haven't seen something with your two little winkles, that means it's not there? You think that your experience and what you see is the measure of everything that there is? Ha ha ha, little Sophie. Just yesterday you didn't even believe in giants, and now you're sitting before one who's telling you he eats snozcumbers. And that's what he eats. You can read the rest of the story to find out what happens next. I will say no more about that. But see, the apostle is talking to a group of people who are inclined, like we would be, to reduce their hope or to start functionally believing things that would unsettle them, that would alarm them, because they're looking at what they see with their own winkles. And they're losing hold of things they've been told. And so he's writing them. We heard in the first chapter he had sent Timothy because he was afraid they'd be unsettled by these trials that they're having. Getting ridiculed, getting the tar beaten out of them, the loss that they're enduring, and then people are dying, and they thought that Jesus was going to come back, and now he's writing them again saying, don't become easily unsettled or alarmed by some prophecy report or letter claiming or supposed to have come from us, saying that the day of the Lord has already happened. Apparently, with their own two little winkles and with their own two little ears, they're hearing some voice, some report somewhere that's saying, hey, Jesus has already come back. Or maybe there's some voice saying, this day of the Lord, this return of Jesus, is kind of a spiritual thing and it's already happened. And they're alarmed. Why are we suffering like this? What are we waiting for? They're not orienting themselves rightly, and he's concerned about them, so he's trying to settle them, to quiet them down, to give them some measure of calm and repose. And so he tries to set the record straight. suggesting they can't just believe what they've seen with their own two little winkles or what they've heard from other voices. They need to make sure that they're measured in which voices they listen to. He's urging them to settle down and to pay attention. He wants them to know the way things really are, and so he refers to what he has already told them. There's a great claim in this, and we'll get to it in a minute. But before we do, I will say this. In this passage, as you heard me read, or recite, did you hear that? Recite. In this passage that you heard me recite, the apostle says some pretty funky stuff. Talking about the man of lawlessness that's going to be revealed after the rebellion. And then the restrainer who's holding back the man of lawlessness until the proper time. Until he moves it out of the way, and then Jesus is going to come and with the breath of his mouth defeat him with the splendor of his coming. And one is left to wonder, what on earth is he talking about? Or maybe you know exactly what he's talking about. St. Augustine in the City of God said this. Augustine, claimed by Catholics and Protestants alike as their daddy. He said, "I frankly confess, I do not know what he means." That's going to be my official party line too. Well, see, the apostle says, after he talks about this description of what has happened or what's going to happen before the end comes, he says, "Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things?" He's had some lengthy conversations, presumably, about this stuff, and we're not let in on all of it. We're getting the Cliff Notes version, or Twitter version of it. A slightly bit more than 164 characters, but not very many more. And so it's hard to know exactly what all he's talking about, but here's the gist that we understand. That there's more going on than we can see with our own two little winkles. That's right. There's more going on than you can see with your eyes. There are spiritual forces at work in the world and in institutions and in people. And there is a battle going on for the earth. There is the apparent reign of evil where wicked things happen and things fall apart. And that this Jesus that we trust, but we cannot see, is ruling over everything, even though it is not apparent to us that he is ruling over everything. And he is going to return to make all things sad come untrue. The apostle has just talked about this. It's going to be phenomenal for some people and utterly terrifying for others. And he's reminding them that this joyous day, because they're on the joyous side of this, is going to come. Anybody who trusts Jesus is on the joyous side of this. And it's going to come, he says. And you're going to know about it. You won't be tricked. You won't be deceived. It will be apparent. Dallas Willard in one place says that the gospel is the benevolent knowledge of the way things really are. The good news of the kingship of Jesus and his rehabilitation of the earth and his propping himself up against the ruination of his people that he made to live with him and for him. On this creation that he made as an epiphany of his presence in every place. That gospel is setting itself up now and will be unmistakably clear later. And that's the way things really are. And you have to pay attention to believe it. You have to, if you want to settle yourself down when you get worked up, when you get overcome, when you get filled with fear or with despair, when you wonder what's going to happen, you have to remember the story that the apostle is saying. Settle down and pay attention, he'd say. Determine which voices are most determinative in your life. Do you know the apostle here at the end? He reminds them. He says, remember what we used to tell you. Don't let anyone deceive you. If anyone tells you different than what we told you, you're deceived. Okay? That's not a very pluralistic, egalitarian, democratic kind of thinking about knowledge or authority. We live in a time, I trust you realize, where it is very easy and very anxiety-producing because we don't know who's in charge. We don't know who the authority is. We don't know which voice should be determinative. And so we listen. There's lots of voices. All the different religions lead to God, some would say, without ever having thought about it for more than 22 seconds. How could they? They're all so different. They all envision different gods. They say such different things about people. Only an unthoughtful person could say that, but people say it. And you hear them say it, you think, well, maybe that's right, because lots of people believe it. You don't know what to do if your pediatrician tells you what you're supposed to do. You take it on advisement. Because you have other sources. You have your friends and you have the interwebs. You have message boards and you read what the ADA, the Dental Association, you read what they said about your child's teeth. You don't know who to trust. It's very hard to know who to trust. And then you have somebody claiming with this kind of audacity, hey, stand firm and hold on to the teachings that we passed on to you, whether by word of mouth or letter. Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things? The apostle has this audacious notion about what he's saying here, about Jesus, about the ultimate overthrow of evil, about our belonging to him. If you delight in the truth, if you want to know the way things really are, and you want to come to God, you belong to him, you are loved by God. And he said, this is the way things are, and you should listen to what I'm saying. Let this be the loudest voice you hear. He has this sense, see, because he has seen things with his two winkles that we haven't. He has this sense that the words that he says are Jesus' own words. He has this sense that he's been given authority to build people up in their faith. That when he gets with them, he can supply what's lacking in their capacity to trust and to see things the way they really are. And the question is, will you listen to him and more broadly to the scriptures? You know, Peter, in one of his letters, says this really interesting thing. He says, our brother Paul says some difficult things to understand. And I think he must have been talking about this passage that we're with today. He says, which ignorant and unstable people distort, which they do to the other scriptures. Peter's saying that Paul's words are scriptures. They're God-breathed. They're God's breath. The same breath that's going to overcome Satan and overcome all evil. The same breath that imagined and then spontaneously made the things that you can see. If that's so, you have a resource here that can counterbalance all kinds of nefarious voices in your life, like the ones in your own head, telling you that you're not enough, you've not done enough, that you're a failure, you haven't come through enough. Nobody likes you. God hates you. He must be severely disappointed with you. You're never going to measure up. Your dimensions aren't right. You're going crazy. You have the Apostle Paul saying, you, brothers, loved by God. You have the Apostle Paul saying, you, because of his physical sacrifice for you, will be presented before God without blemish and free from accusation. So when you find yourself accusing yourself, you have something to battle with. You also have reason to look at your life sometimes and say, what is the authoritative voice that's telling me what I ought to expect? That's telling me how I ought to live, how I ought to conduct family affairs, how I ought to conduct my business. Pete and Jerry Scazzaro, who I really like. I really do like them a lot. They wrote Emotionally Healthy Church and Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. I heard them in a conference once and I've listened to them some. They said, hey, Eric, they're from the Bronx. I didn't. They don't know my name. I'm just kidding. They said very often when we come into God's family, where we have a new boss, we have a new father who directs the course of our lives, very often we, in theory, are committed to letting the authority of God be the prevailing authority in our lives. Letting that commitment override all the other commitments. Or as Brittany just read in Psalm 10, the wicked, in all their thoughts, there is no room for God. And when we come into relationship with God, suddenly all the clutter, the rubbish, everything's moved aside, and right there, like a tree in the middle of a living room, is God orienting us, convincing us how to be and what we're for. But she says, very often, without realizing it, we're not so much as following this God. We're not so much as listening to this Jesus who says, if you know the truth, it'll set you free. But we're really obeying the rules of our family, the family we came from. When it comes to thinking about how we think about ourselves, or how we think about money, or how we think about success, or how we think about how you're supposed to run things, very often we're being ruled without knowing it by voices that came from the family we came from. And so it's worth asking, am I letting the scriptures affect the way I think about this conflict I'm in right now? This conflict where I'm saying, I am not ever going to talk to him again. Well, that may be how they do it in your family, but in God's family, where the authoritative voice of God is, he's all about reconciliation. Not holding men's sins against them. And we're agents of reconciliation. When we think about money, I've got to hold on to this. I've got to make sure I've got enough for a rainy day. We say, is our God stingy or is he generous? He's opened up wide to generously give to the unjust and to the just. That's the story we believe. Does that affect the way I think about my money or my relationships or the way I keep loving somebody who doesn't love me back? Or the way I'm willing to speak what's true, even when it will not be popular? Or even when I butt up against some command of God, his commands for chastity. Avoid sexual immorality, he says. And we bump up against that, and we say, I have desires in me that are so strong and powerful, there ain't no way I can do that. So I'm going to alter the law to fit my reality instead of seeing if I could be altered to fit reality. See, we do that a lot. Nobody in our culture thinks that, except hopefully at least seven Christians still, that if most people think if you have sexual desires or any desire, they should be obeyed. And Christianity says, say what? Christianity says a lot of your desires have gone haywire. They need to be brought in. They need to be tamed. They need to be rightly directed. You can't trust every desire you've got. That's why it's to obey God, you have to disobey yourself sometimes. And of course, that's what makes it so hard. That's what the priest in Moby Dick said. To obey God, you have to disobey yourself. And sometimes that's hard, but God promises that it's right, that it's life. That's what voice should be determinative in our lives. And here's what's comforting. If you realize that the voice who's urging you to live in a certain way, the voice who's claiming to have a true interpretation of history, and do you believe that? That's what Paul thinks. And that's what we have the audacity to believe. We do not think as Christians that we are one choice among many. We believe that we have the true interpretation of Christian. I mean, we have the true interpretation of history and of the future. Now, we may not understand everything about it, but we believe that God created the earth, that people fell into a state of sin. Original sin is the only doctrine, says Chesterton, that can be proven. It's a way homer. You'll get on the way home. And that Jesus said, I'm not going to let the world be ruined or these people ruin themselves. So he stepped into the world in the flesh. He lived the life we should have lived. He died the death we should have died. He resurrected and offers new life, clean slate, forgiveness, acceptance of God, and living with God on the new earth forever and ever, where joy alone is allowed and sorrow and sighing have been banished, prohibited forever. We believe that's where history is moving. If you're not moving in that direction, you're not on the right train. Because that's where history is moving. If you want to have mental health, if you want to be a healthy, stable, not unsettled person, Scott Peck says, mental health is committing yourself to reality at all costs. And that's, of course, what counselors do a lot of times, is they help people shatter their illusions. We live in an illusory world sometimes. Sometimes in a very negative way, we think of ourselves in such negative, awful ways, and everybody around us can say, no, that's not true. This is why people are stuck in addictive patterns. Everybody around them can see how they're self-destructing, and they alone can tell you the reasons why their substance is needful, helpful, useful, and why everybody's against them. Or why they say, if you think you have Alzheimer's, you don't. Because we're sometimes the last to know, you see. But if there are things you can worry about, you know, like crazy people think everybody else is crazy. If you worry that you're crazy, you're not. You're going to have some stuff to think about later. Write these down and see if they're true. They are. See, you've got to have, Paul says that all who are saved have a commitment to the truth. They've embraced this interpretation of the world that says that Jesus is engaged in this battle and he's the actual king who's been resurrected, who's been vindicated, and by God's vindication, raising him from the dead, that means, hey, we better listen to this guy. He has stuff for us. And when he says, I've come that you might have life and life to the full, you are a fool if you don't believe that. Which voices are determinative? Are you committed to the truth at all costs, because the truth will set you free, even though first it might make you miserable? Are you committed to the truth? And if you're going to do that, you've got to be in a community of people who help you to do that. Paul is talking to a church here. He told them last week, encourage each other and build each other up, just as in fact you are doing. He's trying to encourage them. A young man in our congregation came to me this week, teenager, and he said, Pastor Eric, he just said Eric. Reverend Dr. Eric. He said, Eric, last week we were out of town and I was at this thing and somewhere in Georgia there was somebody who had a booth. And he was selling Bibles or something. I missed the details. And the guy said to me, son, do you know that if you die, whether you'll go to heaven or not? And the boy, just around 14-ish, said, yes, I know. I will. He said, why do you think that? Why do you think you're going to go to heaven? And he said, because I believe in Jesus? And the man said, is that enough? And he was concerned. He said, that man said that to me. What do you think about that? And I first said, that man did something very bad to you. That was wrong of him to do that. You know what? Jesus really likes you, and that was not good for... That man probably had good intentions. See, he didn't know what he was getting into here. That man probably had good intentions, but that was an awful thing for him to do. You think you could earn your way to heaven? You could somehow be good enough to earn God's approval? And he said, no. Do you think Jesus lived a life righteous enough to earn your way to heaven? Yes. Do you think that he died to receive all the punishment that was due you? Yes? I said, well, that's enough, man. You're not trusting yourself, you're trusting him. But you know what I think and hope was the most important thing for that young fellow? I hope. Was my adamance. Was my clarity. Because all I'm doing is counting on the word of God. And counting on the generosity of God, that whoever comes to me, I will never turn away. Whoever starts to have the realization, oh no, I'm a person who's desperate on my own. I need God's grace. I need, when I face reality, I can't handle very much of it. I'm so rotten. And to think that this Jesus who's going to eradicate evil let himself be eradicated so that I could not be part of the eradication. I get to be part of sharing in the warmth and the wonder of him who is going to be marveled at among his people when he returns. And so you need a community of people around you who help you believe what is really true. Who help you to see when you can't see with your own two little winkles. That's why you need the church. That's why you need to be a part of a small group. That's why you need other Christian friends. Because we go out into a world who's hostile to these things. Bonhoeffer says, the Christ in my own heart is weak. But the Christ in your heart is certain. You can so very often encourage each other by speaking the truth into each other's lives and helping people see what they can't see. And you can often, can't you, be way more certain for them than you can be for yourself? And of course, the apostle says, as you share your faith, you get to become aware of all the good things you have in Christ. As you try to convince somebody else about the reality of God, you know what happens? I'm going to warn you. You might start believing it more yourself. And I'm thinking that's a good thing. Man, when I get to try to convince somebody and apply the affection of God, which is so hard to believe for us sometimes, into somebody's life and help them frame their lives according to reality, I start to believe it myself more and more and more. You got to figure out whose voices are determinative. You got to figure out, are you going to be committed to the truth? And you got to respond to threats. I will say this, the apostle here is trying to reassure the church in Thessalonica that they're on the side of God's graciousness because they've responded to him. And their response to him is a sign. Like they wanted him because he wanted them first. He chose you to be saved through the sanctifying work of the Spirit and through belief in the truth. But you know, all these terrifying thoughts about Jesus coming and those who do not know God and who do not obey the gospel, who do not obey the truth, they will be shut out from the presence of the Lord. They will be rejected from the majesty of his power. They will be punished with everlasting destruction. I'm going to keep saying these things. God is like a good parent. And if some of you are good parents, there's at least 37% of you in here that are good parents. No, it's much higher. It's at least 40. And some of you who are good parents, you like your kids, don't you? You know, most of the times, except on rainy days. And you might do this sometimes. You might offer threats to them. Threats that you hope you get to enforce, right? Oh. You say, if you don't quit throwing hammers at each other, you will not get to eat macaroni and cheese. If you don't obey your curfew, you will lose your car for a week. If you continue to talk back to me in that manner, you will be grounded for the week. If you do not come to supper when I say, you will not get to use your iPad for 2 days. And when you say these things, is it your secret, cherished, nursed hope that they won't do it? I can't wait to ground these kids and be punished myself. I have to be, I'm just kidding. No! You don't want to punish them. Not if you like them. You hope they'll turn. You hope the threat is enough for them to go, oh! Whoa! There I was for a second, living in an altered state of reality, thinking that I was the only human on the earth. And that my will was the only one that mattered. You're hoping that your threat is like a smack upside the head, a figurative one. That means a not really one. You're hoping that your threat jolts them into seeing what's true, namely, that there are other wills on planet Earth that matter besides their own. That there's more to this world than just you and what you want. And of course, isn't that the hardest thing for any of us to learn? Isn't that a source of so much of your dissatisfaction and disaffection and discontentedness and just the murky waters of your sourness sometimes? It's because all the people around you don't realize how hard they're making it for you. The person in front of you won't drive fast enough. Your husband won't bring you enough flowers and get you fancy things. Your kids are making it hard for you when you want to be. We want everything to be quiet. Your parents are making you go somewhere when you know good and well the best thing to do is to play video games for the whole rest of your life. It's so irritating, isn't it, that there are other people? And they make claims on you and they ask things of you. And well, see, that's indigenous to our state. But then, so if the wicked, the people who do not frame themselves to the truth, ideally what's going to happen is they hear this threat. Hey, there's a king. He's coming. He's going to eradicate evil. And you're going to be part of that eradication if you don't lay down your arms and stop being his enemy. Stop defending yourself against him. And here's why you can. He's really graciously disposed towards you. He's threatening you because he likes you. He wants you to be part of this. He wants to forgive you your sins. A lot of you staying away from him is you think he's going to ruin your life. No, no, no. You're going to ruin your life if you don't come to him. See, the threats are always given so that you'll turn. When Jonah marched around Nineveh, it's part of why he got so cotton big and angry at God. 40 more days and Nineveh will be overturned. He breaks out a kazoo. Burr, 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 burr. He's so excited. These ruthless Ninevites are got to get it, the hand of God, an intrusion of his judgment. Boom, like a squash bug under a kid's boot. And then they repent and they say, oh my gosh, you're right. We need to come to God. And then God says, okay, that's what I wanted. No punishment. And Jonah says, what's wrong with you? I knew you were going to do that, you merciful God. What a story. He's mad at him because he showed mercy to people because they heard the threat and they turned. That's what any wise person will do when they hear a threat. God doesn't give the threats because he just can't wait. Dallas Willard said, my concept of hell is very simple. It's God's best for some people. It's the best God can do for those who don't like him. The worst would be to make them be with him. Now what that means is separation from God because people in hell want to be away from God, so he lets them. If you spend your life wanting to be away from God, eventually he'll say, okay, that's what you get. And your world's going to shrivel into this steady diet of yourself that's going to be small and eternal hell, destruction, judgment. People who don't like God enough to seek him and spend time with him here are very likely to find heaven agonizing. You realize heaven's going to be where God is. And he likes you and he wants you. This is a long sermon. I'm closing here. I've got to tell you about Charlotte's Web. You know Charlotte's Web? The chapter called The Bad News. Wilbur Pig. A talking pig. It's a story. It's told by one of the sheep. Seems to me you're putting on weight. Yes, I guess I am, replies Wilbur. At my age, it's a good idea to keep gaining. Just the same, said the old sheep. But you know why they're fattening you up, don't they? Don't you? No. Well, I don't like to spread bad news, said the sheep. But they're fattening you up because they're going to kill you. That's why. They're going to what? Screamed Wilbur. Kill you. Turn you into bacon and smoked ham, continued the old sheep. Almost all young pigs get murdered by the farmer as soon as the real cold weather sets in. There's a regular conspiracy around here to kill you at Christmas time. Merry Christmas, Wilbur! Everybody's in on the plot. Lurvy, Zuckerman, even John Arable. Mr. Arable? Fern's father? Certainly. When a pig's to be butchered, everybody helps. This is the glee of it. I'm an old sheep, and I see the same thing. Same old business. Year after year, Arable arrives with his 22, shoots the... Stop! Screamed Wilbur. I don't want to die. Save me, somebody. Fern was just about to jump up when a voice was heard. Be quiet, Wilbur, said Charlotte, the spider, who had been listening to this awful conversation. I can't be quiet, screamed Wilbur, racing up and down. I don't want to be killed. I don't want to die. Is it true what the old sheep says, Charlotte? Is it true they're going to kill me when the cold weather comes? Well, she is an old sheep. She's been around. She's seen some things. If she says so, probably that's right. Wilbur burst into tears. I don't want to die. I want to stay alive right here in the comfortable manure pile with my friends, just like all of you. I want to breathe the beautiful air and lie in the beautiful sun. I don't want to die, screamed Wilbur, throwing himself to the ground. You shall not die, said Charlotte briskly. What? Really? Said Wilbur. Who's going to save me? I am, said Charlotte. How? That remains to be seen, but I'm going to save you, and I want you to quiet down immediately. You're carrying on in a childish way. Stop your crying. I can't stand hysterics. And in a chapter called Last Day, after she spun her magical webs, making pronouncements over Wilbur, some pig, radiant, fantastic, humble, she's altered the perception of those around. And she says, your future, Wilbur, is assured. You will live safe and secure, Wilbur. Nothing can harm you now. The autumn days will shorten and grow cold. The leaves will shake loose from the trees and fall. Christmas will come, then the snows of winter, and you will live to enjoy the beauties of the frozen world because you mean a great deal to Zuckerman, and he will not harm you. Ever. Winter will pass. The days will lengthen. The ice will melt. The song sparrow will return and sing. The frogs will awake. The warm wind will blow again. All these sights and sounds and smells will be yours to enjoy, Wilbur. This lovely world, these precious days. And Will, Charlotte stopped. And a tear came to Wilbur's eye. Oh, Charlotte, to think that when I first met you, I thought you were cruel and bloodthirsty. When he recovered, he said, why did you do all this for me? I don't deserve it. I've never done anything for you. She says some things, and then she said this. I wove my webs for you because I liked you. You shall not die. You shall have no harm befall you. This is the benevolent news of how things really are. You must commit yourself over and over to this truth that your steadfast security comes from the King who will overthrow all evil with the breath of his mouth and the splendor of his coming, and he likes you. And he says, come to me, and I'll never turn you away. And then come back some more, and I'll never turn you away, and I'll live in you. And I'll make you a living depiction of the warmth and wonder of who I am so that you can show the world the reality of things they cannot see with their own two little winkles. Let's pray.